What's up and welcome to Sweathead with Mark Pollard. Today I have Lucky General's co-founder and UK's Planner of the Year, which I am convinced is going to be the name of a Netflix series. Also, Andy Nan has won this as a series like 3, 4, 5, 10, about 45 times, right? Andy, today we're going to talk about the Lucky General's deal with TBWA. I've sprung that on you. I'm going to milk some information out of you. We'll talk about your book, Go Unluck Yourself, and also strengths and weaknesses of planners, because you're going to be doing a masterclass for us with Sweathead. It's called 3 Hours of Planning Superpowers. And if I can give it a quick plug, that's happening on February 23 from 12 to 3 p.m. New York time. People can find out details about that at sweathead.com. Andy, Lucky General's sold, is that the correct verb, sold to TBWA?
Yeah, we sold a majority stake. We've still got quite a big chunk ourselves, the three founders and a couple of other people. But yeah, we did the deal 5 years ago now. And you're going to ask me what difference it's made. I think I can tell this question.
You're just going to interview yourself now, are you? That's a cocky interviewee. You think I'm that predictable? My first question was going to be, why did you do it in the first place? And how old was Lucky Generals at the time?
We weren't very old. The funny thing is, I reckon we were... I've just lost track of time over the last couple of years in particular. It feels like the last 2 years have been a decade. So I'm guessing that we were maybe 5 years old. I think this happened in 2000 and either 17 or 18, 17 maybe. So about 4 or 5 years old, you know, which is quite young. But when we weren't looking to sell, that was the interesting thing. That was not our game plan, not in any shape or form what we were thinking of doing. And then we had some really interesting conversations with somebody we'd met before and been really impressed by, Troy Ruhannon, who's the global head of all things TBWA. We really, really liked him, and he came over and was extremely charming and persistent and lovely and persuasive. And actually, we said, no, we weren't interested. So he went away again. And then he came back again, and he was still very interested and very persuasive. And we all, again, really liked him. And originally the idea was to merge us. I think this is sort of not a big secret. This, the classic model is to perhaps merge an agency like us with a big network agency and, you know, sort of superimpose some of the sort of startup-y stuff onto the big network agency. You know, that's what worked with Adam and Eve, for instance, didn't it, in the UK? We said we didn't want to do that. So again, Troy went, fine, great. And then it was another few months down the line and he said, well, what if we bought a majority stake, not the whole thing, and we didn't merge you. You just continued to do effectively your independent best, but you'll now have the benefit of, you know, obviously personal financial sort of security and so on. And I'm just going to leave you alone, I promise, because like, why would I try and kill the golden goose sort of thing? And I have to say, he's been true to that promise ever since. So it's been a great thing for us.
It's almost textbook Innovator's Dilemma by Clayton Christensen, where one of the main things that companies, as they get bigger and get older, struggle with is culture. And connected to that is often clients or customers. They don't want the company to change that much because they bought into them years ago. And so companies like Kodak and IBM and all, like, big tech companies went through this. And so the Innovator's Dilemma often leads to the thought of like a skunk work. So you just set up lots of little divisions that can innovate. But what they're trying to do in those little divisions is create their own subcultures to then chase new ways of making money with new products. And if they're successful, then the big company is like, well, do we sell it? Do we absorb it back in? Or they do what they did with you, which is they acquire you. Now, obviously, there has been a history of some of those acquisitions occurring, and then the magic goes. Lucky Generals is doing pretty well. So how have you allowed or made the magic happen? And by the way, I'm not slurring TBWA in that, because TBWA is an exceptional agency with an exceptional history, but there's been a history of agencies being bought, founders kind of just waiting for their big payout. They disappear, and then the agency's gone within a year or two after that happens. How have you kept the magic alive? Is that even a silly question?
No, it's not. It's exactly what that has bothered us and why we didn't want to sell to anybody. A little bit of history. We had previously run an agency together. Basically, three of us at Lucky Generals, for those of you who don't sort of know us so well, is me and my two long-term friends and, you know, sort of partners. Helen had started this. Helen Calcraft had started a very successful business in the UK called MCBD, and then my other partner Danny and I had sort of ran it with her. You know, so it was the three of us and had a great old time, achieved lots of good things together. And then we chose to merge it with another agency, actually. And to be honest, we hated it. It was one of those things that did look amazing on paper. Like, we were literally the IP effectiveness agent of the year. They were the digital agency of the decade. Everybody on paper said, this is, wow, what a clever thing to have done back in whenever it was 2011 or something like that. And anyway, we absolutely fucking hated it. It was through nobody's sort of particular sort of fault, but we just didn't enjoy it. So that was a brilliant, sometimes things like that are really good ways of reminding you what you don't want to do and then also what you do want to do. So when it came to those sort of conversations, the one thing we knew we were absolutely never going to do was sell to anyone that was going to change our culture, try and create a merger, do anything that was spoiling all the stuff that we were loving and enjoying. You have personal things though, you know, what people often don't see on the outside world is they're beyond the corporate entity. There's three people trying to get on with their lives. One of us at the time, so Helen, and again, this is in the public domain, I think I'm oversharing, you know, was going through a horrible battle with cancer at the time for the second time. And, you know, the rest of us, we've all got, you know, things going on in our lives that are not necessarily the things that get written about in campaigns. You have to think about you and your families. This is our choice to make for our security and our families and so on. So you've got to make that call, you know, with your agency as your work baby. So you are very protective about your literal family and their future, but also your work child, if you like. So we were incredibly sort of resistant, really, to dear old Troy, but he really encouraged us because, as you said, they are a great, I think they're the agency network of the year in the last couple of years running. And he just struck us as a proper straight up guy. And if anything, our work has got stronger over the last 4 or 5 years. I mean, the last 5 years, we've made the most watched ad in the world 4 out of those 5 years, which is sort of mind blowing, really. All for Amazon.
Can you name check them? All for Amazon?
Yeah, All for Amazon. So it's the Amazon Super Bowl ad. And so you might say, well, of course they're going to. But actually, the 1 year they didn't use us, I might have to point out, and they used a very good agency, and not to denigrate them, but it was nowhere near it. So it's a nice little controlled experiment there, I thought.
All right, give me a couple more questions on this topic. Why did you launch the brand in the US? You know, there's two pieces of context I want to give you. One is I've spoken to, you know, youngish UK agency owners who are like, yeah, going to bring the brand over to the US. I'm like, okay, if you've got an in, if you're already working with a Google or a Nike or whatever, okay, that can happen, but it's quite different. And the Brits that I've spoken with who want to move here, they're often quite attracted to the more intellectual advertising person. I'm like, it's really different. You need like a capital B business person out there selling. It's quite different. And a lot of them come for a year or two and they don't quite survive, but they have that beautiful London. We're going to like do some more advertising colonialism. Two is what I found interesting in New York, having been in a lot of agencies, and I was temporarily helping to run Leo Burnett New York. It was small. And so I've heard a lot of the conversations around these large agencies that sometimes get over-dependent on a couple of big conservative clients. 5 years later, they're not making good work. They're finding it hard to hire people. That makes it even harder to make good work. And they kind of just become addicted to like a big bank or a big insurance company. And I never know what they're even making. And so sometimes the discussion is like, no, we've got to work out how to bring in some new talent, some fresh talent. Maybe we should launch a thing on the side or we should buy an agency. That was a lot of information. But why did you decide to and agree to launching Lucky Generals as a brand in the US?
That bit's easy. So we were already making loads of good work in the States. I mean, again, perhaps this blurs into the first thing about why did we do the deal with TBWA? We did want to expand and we knew that we'd be much better able to do that if we had the backing and support of a great collective of agencies. So there was a bit of muscle behind us that would allow us to do that. And we did it with huge humility, actually, if that's not an oxymoron. But can I say that? And it doesn't make sense really to say. We were incredibly humble. Sort of contradictory. We tried to be humble because, like you say, we just know that, oh my God, this is a completely different market. Nobody knows who we are. You know, we can't pretend that we are known in the States in the way that we're, you know, very well-known individuals in the UK market. Let's not kid ourselves. It's full of amazing agencies doing brilliant work on their best days. Like you say, we're very conscious if you're walking through a graveyard of agencies that we really respect over here that have crashed and burned. And actually the opposite applies also. You know, there's so many great American agencies have come to London thinking the same thing and they've crashed and burned. So what we had tried to do was go relatively, don't make a big song and dance when you land and come say, yeah, we're going to change the advertising market in New York and everybody's rubbish and we're going to show you the new way to do things. We just sort of felt our way in. We always sort of joke that we launched rather unfortunately on the 19th of COVID. That's how we sort of phrased it. You know, it was sort of like just imminently before it all went horribly sort of wrong. So that was a bit unfortunate that we couldn't have predicted. But again, that's when you, if you've got a network behind you, that is miles more easy than if we had done this all of our own savings and put a couple of million in, then you really would be in a very bad, bad, dark place. So we got through those couple of years. It wasn't perfect, I guess, for anybody really in the industry, but we've come out the other side. So, and we still don't make any big claims about, you know, we know it's on, you know, early days. What we like is the fact our work seems to resonate in the States, you know, whether it's a Super Bowl or stuff we've done for Bush or for Virgin Atlantic. So I feel like on a good day, we can challenge and be up there with the best of them. But we know that there's a lot of good agencies there. We're not counting our chickens.
Yeah, it's super competitive, very sales oriented, very transactional, and very volatile in good and not good ways. You know, like America's infatuated with reorgs, hiring and firing. But the thing is, if you can get on the roller coaster in the right way. So, for example, if you somehow manage to land a big client with lots of marketers and maybe lots of sub-brands, and you get one piece of work through that the CMO presents to the whole marketing department, a whole marketing group is like amazing. All of a sudden, for the next 12 to 24 months, every marketer is like, I want that. I saw that up close at General Mills. There was this new approach to the brand Nature Valley about 11 years ago. And as soon as that was announced at their sort of annual kickoff, every marketer is like, I want that. I want that. I want that. Did that happen for you with, like, for Amazon, for example?
Yeah, Amazon's been great. I mean, we started off working on Amazon as their first ever. You got to remember, Amazon previously didn't believe in advertising, very famously, absolutely rejected the whole concept of advertising. And so when we were about 1 year old, we sort of crazily ended up being their first ever British agency. We were so small. It was funny. We did this meeting. We were only about like 12 of us or something like that. And we were thinking, God, this is ridiculous. They're never going to choose us. We're so tiny. And so we got people in our building that worked at other companies, and even a couple of guys who were washing the windows. We got them, can you sit in our office and put your jackets around on the chairs and stuff like that? Just make it look as if there's more of us. Anyway, so we thought, that's clever, right? We've doubled our size now. We're not 12 or 24. And when they came in, they sort of said, oh, this is a bit disappointing. There's more of you than we thought. And we went, what do you mean? Said, we were hoping you'd be a bit smaller, because like, we're obviously huge. We don't want a big. And they had this whole rule about the two pizza rule. Have you heard this? Like, if Bezos used to say, if your team's too, you know, big to be fed on a couple of pizzas, you're too big. So we'd really shot ourselves in the foot. We idiotically tried to make ourselves big when they really weren't small. So we had to quickly get rid of the guys in the window cleaning costumes. And then after that, we went from little British briefs to pan-European briefs to the global holidays briefs, you know, all around the world we've done for the last 6 years. And then Super Bowl was the kind of culmination, I guess, of the biggest brief in the Amazon ecosystem. So do you know what? We've never been on a retainer in the 9 years we've worked with them. We've pitched for pretty much everything, every project. That keeps you on your toes, and they can obviously speak to any, you know, brilliant agency around the world. They've got a great roster of agencies. So you just have to do your best and hope that you get the next gig as well.
I've heard similar stories. I think there's an Australian called Simon Reynolds who was known for trying to set up shop in New York and hired models and interns to fill out an office space, even though there was only like one or two people. And then it is funny when big companies meet you and they say certain things. I remember I was at Big Spaceship and we won Samsung Mobile, all their social media presence, which was really, really big. And like, first of all the work that we pitched, they didn't really care. They just wanted a cool, small agency in Brooklyn to work with. We're like, hey, we busted our guts. Like, what do you mean? You don't care about all the work that we presented. And it's just funny to hear some of the comments. You start to realize that they're shopping for agencies, almost like going to the store to see which fruit and vegetables they want to buy today, like going to Tesco's. I was going to say TJ Maxx for clothing, but I was like, hang on, is TJ Maxx in the UK? But yeah, it's like they're buying, I don't know, cereal. But it's like, no, it's us. Very cool. What are the next plans for Lucky Generals that you can discuss and please overshare?
We are hitting our 10th birthday this year, which seems like terrifying, but great too.
Happy birthday.
Well, thank you. You do get to that stage where you've got to not rest on your laurels. You can't ever think, well done us, we've achieved a bunch of stuff, pat on the back. In fact, I think we're all three as individuals, we're all very much about not beating ourselves up either, because you've got to take moments to sort of enjoy the stuff you've done, but you've got to do that with an eye on, right, how do we do better stuff? How do we bring new people through? You know, I hired my first CSO just a couple of months ago.
Are you feeling threatened?
I bloody am. She's amazing. In a good way, I want to be threatened. I want to be kept on my toes. You know, it doesn't mean that I'm going anywhere. It just means that I've got someone, I mean, joking aside, not threatening, but sort of a good challenge to all the things that I've sort of built up, all my little quirks and things like that, that I've just taken for granted for all these years. It's quite nice if someone brilliant comes in and says, yeah, but why don't we do things this way? I'm enjoying that. And, you know, we're trying to do that across the piece, really get people in we hired this amazing tabloid journalist who actually was our first client, our very first client at Paddy Power. It was the head of mischief there and previously was, you know, editor of the Daily Star, which is like really sort of noisy, outrageous tabloid. People like that bring a different mentality to your work and just bring a different flavor.
I can see that. I was at a .com who brought in someone similar and they were very quick with words that would get to the jugular immediately. It's just straight up drama all the time. And it's interesting to see where that kind of brain goes. You don't want to be on the receiving end of it, though.
No, I mean, he's lovely. He's the nicest tabloid person you can ever imagine. But it's the visualization as well. It's like you say, it's very quick communication. It's like, what would the front page be? What is the most amazing picture? And how do you condense that to like three words? And we think that we are good at doing that in our industry. But I think those guys, whether you like them or not, there's a real skill there. So that's really what we want to do, keeping ourselves on our tools, really. Do different stuff.
Smart person. Hey, pull your mind out of those timesheets for a second and take a look at the Sweaterhead website. We have three membership levels, Starter Mode, Flight Mode, and Beast Mode. They give you access to a variety of strategy masterclasses, conferences, accelerators, and online learning, some of which has been known to make people cry because they like it, they like it, they feel seen. Make the most of your mind this year or any year and visit www.sweathead.com today. Now back to the interview.
Let's quickly chat Go Luck Yourself, and then I want to discuss strengths and weaknesses. So you released Go Luck Yourself, was it 2 years ago now?
2 years, I think, yeah.
Sell the idea to us. What's the idea of the book?
This is a good idea of doing, you know, something different I'd never done before in all these years. I've never written books. So I thought this is quite good. The premise is that luck is literally a four-letter word in Western business. It's a taboo. We don't like to talk about it. In fact, it's really quite insulting if I were to say that someone is lucky. And yet, anyone who's actually worked in business, in private or secretly, will tell you they've had a bit of luck along the way. I don't believe anyone that's not had luck along the way of their successes. So I thought it'd be interesting to explore that taboo in a really practical way that allows us to make more of our luck. So that's really what it's about, is making the most of your luck. And what I found was that, you know, really luck is about statistics and math. It's not, we think it's some sort of silly, superstitious thing that we can't do anything about. But a lot of the time it's about gaming the system and changing the statistics and the probabilities. We can all remember our high school maths so that we're more likely to achieve the things that we want in life. I thought it was something nice because I sort of wrote this at the time of, you know, just as the pandemic started. And I like the idea of writing a book about luck that brought luck to other people. So all the royalties and all the profits and all the licensing fees, every single penny goes to a really good cause called Commercial Break that helps working class kids get a lucky break into the industry. So it's a kind of a karma exercise as well.
I love it. Is there one particular chapter? Because the chapters are essentially, it's like your portfolio, really. It's like Andy's history of work, where you explain through story certain interactions, situations that you had that led to certain ideas and solutions, with then, I guess, some tips that people can extrapolate from that story. What's the one that you love the most?
I've got a lot of fondness for a thing that we worked on called Hovis. It's one of the best known brands in Britain, really. It's a bread brand. Incredibly famous advertising history. Probably the most famous ad of all time in Britain was an ad by Ridley Scott in the 1970s. And it was featured a little boy pushing a bike up a hill in a cobbled town. It was very old-fashioned. It was deliberately set in, you know, Victorian times. And it's not run for decades, but everyone remembers it as the most famous ad of all time. Unfortunately, though, that also meant that it was feeling very old-fashioned and just past it, really. And so it was losing share at an incredible rate. And we were sort of told that, you know, the one thing you mustn't do is go anywhere near history. That's the last thing. You know, you should focus on all the new and interesting stuff that we're doing and all that kind of stuff, which made sense, except that none of that seemed to work either. And so we got a new CMO who said, look, I don't care what you do, just no restrictions, but you need to do something absolutely spectacular because otherwise we're going to be delisted and the game is up. So we sort of went back to the archives, really, and we realized, and this is why it said in Go Luck Yourself, is that it was an example of a company that didn't appreciate how lucky they were. They had an amazing backstory, a history, an incredible record of being set up over 100 years ago, doing all sorts of incredible things through their history that they had convinced themselves was a terrible thing to talk about and would make them look backwards. And we said, no, actually, you are so lucky to be in that position. Obviously, what you've got to do is bring it up to date and show that you're relevant today, but don't just throw the baby out with the bathwater. And so we created an ad that went on to be voted the British public's favourite ad of the decade that, again, featured a young boy, a again with a loaf of bread. But this time he was running through the events of history all the way from the Victorian age up into the current day with a loaf of bread, you know, through the miners' strike, through two world wars, England winning the World Cup and all the rest of it. And then he puts the loaf of bread on the table. And the line at the end was as good today as it's always been. It won everything, including, you know, helping that brand survive. Actually, it was the fastest growing food brand of the year. But it was just an amazing, huge sort of cultural success story. The public loved it. And I've got fondness for that because that was really the thing. It was just before we launched Lucky Generals, but that was the thing that brought us together as a team, the three founders, and said, yeah, we can do this. We should do this for ourselves. And so I've got a lot of sort of personal sort of fondness for it as well.
Well, I love it. Yeah. Like if any planner who spends any time in the industry will get a brief to say, how do we celebrate our 10 year, 50 year anniversary? If you do focus groups, people will say, I don't care about the history. What's in it for me now? So you need to make a connection between the history and the future. But also I'm kind of curious about this because, you know, Brexit, UK, the Royals, etc. The US is very forward-looking, short-term memory. The UK is often, despite the incredible intellect over there, it seems quite insular to me. I have family from the old East End and Warrington. That's my people. I'm not criticizing. I just want to get your take on this. The UK right now, especially if I watch the politics and what people are talking about, I'm like, it's so not forward-looking, one, and two, quite insular. Can you correct me?
Yeah, I'm going to confirm it, unfortunately. There's a horrible, horrible, horrible regression, I think. I think, I mean, without getting totally pseudo-intellectual and sort of delving into history, I think Britain and England in particular has really struggled with its, you know, decades beyond empire and still believes it's this great global power and harks back to some golden age that probably was never golden age in the first place. And things like Brexit are unpleasant sort of taste of that. Whereas I think Britain at its best can celebrate the past and the future. And that's what we tried to do in that ad. So as well as, you know, having things from the suffragettes and, you know, the various sort of struggles and great things of the past, we did celebrate, you know, the arrival of the first immigrants. You know, the little boy runs down a street and sees people arriving at the ports from different parts of the world. And we see the transition to a modern, exciting, multicultural, cool, interesting Britain that also exists. And I think that was captured brilliantly at, for instance, at the 2012 Olympics. I don't know if you remember the show, but that really struck me as Britain at its best, which was Danny Boyle, the film director, was given sort of license to create the opening ceremony. And it did have a lot of brilliant things from the past, but it just felt like a brilliant modern sort of iteration of it rather than some of the sort of pathetic stuff that we have at the moment.
I wish I could spend more time over there at some point. I want to get a few months over there. I have a dream of one day living in a place where football, soccer, is the main sport.
Ah, there you go.
And also, just came across Kunk on Earth, which I know has been around the UK for a while, but it's only just making its way to the US. It's on YouTube. Have you seen it? It's like Deborah Morgan? Amazingly written. And I think it's actually something that strategists should watch. And there's an Ali G vibe in it where the character Philomena something interview.
Yeah, I do know that. Yeah. I do know it. Sorry. I do, of course. She's amazing.
Interviews historians about Britain, et cetera, et cetera. But the writing is so concise and it's so twisted. You can tell 10 people have written each sentence, maybe. I don't even know why I said that, but like, it's just so crafted. I love it. All right, let's chat strengths and weaknesses. There's something that I've thought about over the years, and I don't know if you found this when you were growing up. I deal and speak with a lot of strategists, and they're not shy of bringing up their insecurities with me. I have a point of view, and I want your reaction to this. When managers focus a lot of their attention and feedback on a strategist's weakness, it's because they're trying to make the strategist feel insecure so that they can control them. Let's start there. What's your reaction to that?
I do think there's some truth in that. And I think you sort of know a little bit. This is my desire is always to try and get focus on the good stuff rather than poke around the flaws. I think naturally there's something about planners that often we focus on our flaws anyway. So I don't need someone else telling us how crap we are at something because we're already probably conscious of it and telling ourselves about it. And I really, through the years, have known all sorts of things I've not been good at. But then you come to live with them and realize that you presumably good at other stuff, and you just accept, and this is really the premise of the thing I'm going to be doing with you guys in a couple of weeks, you know, start with your superpowers that you're brilliant at, the things that you enjoy doing. And again, that's why we set up Lucky Generals. We had worked out, as I said, what we didn't like doing. We did that merger and we hated it for all the reasons that we didn't like it. So let's just focus on doing the stuff we like with the people we like, have a brilliant time, have a laugh together with our friends, and just, we don't need to do all the crap. We only need to do 0.5% of the advertising business would make us, you know, crazily successful beyond our wildest dreams. We don't have to go for the other 99.5%. Somebody else can do that. And that's been our sort of spirit.
That's the kind of accounting that I like. Debit, credit. What do I like doing? What don't I like doing? And yes, it can take a few years to you until you get to the point where you can really bring those things to life or center them in your life, because you need a bit of experience so that you can have a bit of power so that you can make those things happen. Was there a particular weakness that perhaps chewed on a lot, especially in your 20s, where you're like, oh, I really got to improve this? And then later we're like, nah, you know what? I'm going to focus on the strengths.
Definitely. The big one that I got all the time, I was quite quiet. And I think that's what maybe is true of a lot of planners, again, especially young planners. I've said to you before, I came down from Scotland. Maybe that wasn't a big deal of it, but I did feel like a bit of a fish out of water in London. And you're in this kind of strange, glamorous, exciting world, which was a million miles from where I grew up. And I was shy and just nervous and sort of, you know, drinking it all in, really. And so I got all the time, oh, you're quiet, you're not saying enough, you need to find your voice, you need to say something, have an opinion. All of which, to some degree, is good advice, but not when it makes you really self-conscious about it, because that makes you worse, or makes you feel like you've got to say something, and then you say something stupid and feel bad about that as well. So definitely my first few years were consumed by this kind of sense that I wasn't saying enough, and there were many more people who were saying much more stuff. But then I realized what I was good at was listening to stuff. You know, I wasn't just sitting doing nothing in these meetings. I was listening to everybody else, and I was kind of listening to, you know, what they did, and did it work or did it not work? And then I realized that that is like such an important part as being a planner, is to be able to listen and then do something with it. And so many of the best planners that I really admire have been, you know, not the loudest people, but just the best listeners. And so I feel like that's the thing not to get disheartened by if you're in your 20s and people are giving you that feedback, because you will win in the end, because you're probably going to be a great listener.
Yeah, it is interesting, I think, in personal life, but also in professional life, when other people want to spend a lot of time telling you about you. What is that? And if you have moved countries, cities, speak a little bit differently, maybe it's a new language, let alone a different accent, you can really internalize that, and it could affect you for 5 or 10 years. Not necessarily cripple you, but it can really take its toll. When someone's a few years in, they might not really have experience to work out what their superpowers are. How does someone approach that?
I think if you've got a good boss, they should be identifying it. And it is a balance, because you don't want people to calcify. You know, there might be things that you should develop that you're less good at. I think you just got to start with the premise that, you know, this is the thing that you're absolutely brilliant at, and let us, you know, encourage and develop that. And then if there are things that you're less good at, then let's pick the ones that you're less good at, but you could, you know, and should sort of focus on, but not pretend that you've got to be brilliant at everything. I think that's a mistake, is that none of us can be brilliant at everything. So, and what we sometimes do is choose things because we think we should develop those skills. We're not really all that interested in. You know, classic one was things like, you know, global advertising. I remember a couple of times, so I got past that stage about not speaking too much. And I think the next thing I thought I had to do was, do lots of global stuff, because that felt like, I don't know, the thing to do. And I kept hearing that the world was going global and you needed that experience and it was different. I just didn't like it. I hated it. Some people are very good at that. So I totally admire people who've got the patience to sit with all these different stakeholders and find some sort of common ground without it being the lowest common denominator. I mean, that's a brilliant skill set for people who can do that. But for whatever reason, I'm not good at that, and or I certainly don't enjoy it. And so I just wasted some time trying to do it badly. And I've sort of more figured that, with the odd exception, I'm better leaving that to people who are brilliant at it.
There are a few spreadsheets that have been going around from, I don't know, 5 to 8 years now, which have the levels of strategists. So, you know, junior strategist, senior strategist, strategy director, and up. And then like a matrix of all the skills that they need to have to graduate, right? And I see these and I'm like, wow, they're really well thought through, but also no.
Yeah.
Like maybe someone's good at 3 things and over a decade, they could be the best in the world at those 3 things. But the thing is, like, the younger people often interpret those spreadsheets as like, I've got to like get good at all of these 20 skills before I can move on. And I just think it's this weird, fussy HR career corporate stuff in people's heads. It's not real.
That is the problem, I think. That's exactly it. where I feel, you know, now obviously I'm more likely to be placing other people on accounts and so on. And when I do that, I don't need you to be brilliant at everything. I probably need you to be brilliant, hopefully, at the thing that that particular account requires. So I'd rather put someone who's brilliant at that sort of global management type sort of thing on the global account. And if someone's brilliant at, you know, with numbers or very numerate and sort of data mining, I'd put them on that particular account and all those sort of things. Obviously, like I say, you can then countercast as well. If someone is really saying, do you know what, I really feel like I should develop some new skills and not just stick with, you know, you don't want to pigeonhole people either, then you can do that. But it's not about having people who are average at everything. You might as well let people play to their brilliant strengths. I was speaking to a lady the other day who's a very senior strategist, who's absolutely brilliant. And she was beating herself up about it. She was sort of saying, I'm not quick enough at coming to the big ideas. And I was sort of saying, yeah, but you're also brilliant. I mean, A, I don't think that is necessarily right about this person, but taking ideas and building them and developing them over time, you've got incredible stamina. And we were kind of saying that she's sort of more like a marathon runner. I'm not good at that. I'm sort of more like a sprinter, and then I'll lose, you know, lose energy and fall over sort of thing. So we often work really well. You know, I might work at the beginning of a project and then she might sort of carry it forward sort of thing. And that's a brilliant partnership. I love working with her. But either one of us would be less good if we tried to do the other thing, probably.
The thing that I'll point out to anybody who's listening to this, who's started to recently manage people, is the word casting. USHR, like, there's something about the corporate DNA here, which is like, refuses to see people, right? Whereas what you'll often hear with heads of planning from other countries is like, no, I put person A on opportunity A because it was a good match, rather than sort of this more robotic factory-like approach. Final question for you. What would you say to young Andy? Let's say he's approached you and he's like, I'm getting feedback that I'm too quiet. I think I'm okay at listening. What would you say to him?
I feel like I'd say, don't, because this is the other thing that young people do, that I did. You look too far ahead and worry about, you know, and plan, because we're planners, plan our careers and think, all right, I'm going to do 5 years of this and then 5 years of that. And you're better to just do the thing you're doing and enjoy it and be great at it. Don't look too far ahead, because who knows what incredible things are going to happen in this industry. You just have to keep yourself in an interesting, curious state of play so that when new and interesting stuff comes around, you can choose how you engage with it sort of thing.
Well, I'm going to do an aggressive plug right now. If you want to hear Andy, not hear, if you want to participate in exploring your own superpowers for 3 hours on February 23, please check out the details at sweathead.com. Andy's fun. He does surprising things. He brings toys to his classes. I don't even think you're going to use a deck, Andy. That's how bold and brave you are these days.
No deck or anything like that. It's just going to be all props and maybe a bit of drawing, maybe a bit of music, other silly stuff like that. Just to, yeah, we need to have fun in our lives too.
Well, may you and your fellow generals continue to be lucky, and look forward to seeing your next big campaigns. I guess we're going to see some stuff at the Super Bowl, aren't we?
We shall see. Thank you, mate. I really enjoyed chatting.
Awesome. Thank you, Andy.
Peace. Thank you for listening to this episode of Sweathead. If you enjoyed it, please share it with a friend, subscribe to our newsletter, find us on Instagram or LinkedIn at Sweathead. And if you're interested in finding out about our strategy memberships, company training, or books, visit sweathead.com. Whoop, whoop.